Here we are. This is Real World Radio on air. 3w.realworldradio.fm.
Real World Radio welcomes Asad Rehman. He's a member of Friends of the Earth England, Wales and Northern Ireland and has been working very, very hard from the beginning of this United Nations talks on climate change here in Paris. First thing, Asad, welcome to Real World Radio.
Thank you. I'm very welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
Asad, the world is being told from yesterday at the end of the COP that finally our political leaders came up with an agreement which is going to save the world. What do you have to say about that?
Well, if you judge an agreement on the basis of political pragmatism, then of course some people may celebrate that. But if you judge an agreement rooted in both the science and does it deliver justice for those people already being impacted by climate change and the millions, if not billions, of people who are likely to be affected by climate change, then unfortunately the agreement is not strong enough and is not something to celebrate. I think what we've got here is an illusion that what we've seen is real concrete progress. When you actually start to look into the agreement, what we see is the little, if no action, in terms of trying to deliver the critical 1.5 degree threshold. Look, you know, no temperature level is safe. We know that. Our people all around the world already know that. But scientists tell us that if we breach 1.5, that's the guardrail. Beyond that, we get into the kind of catastrophic climate change that will make all the severe impacts that we're seeing around the world, the droughts, the floods, the famines, much more intense, much more regular, and will devastate many, many more people's lives and livelihoods. And on that critical issue, we don't see a clear pathway. We don't see the scale of ambition that in terms of the emission reduction cuts that are needed by rich countries. We don't see that. In the finance, the critical finance that's needed for poorer countries to be able to deal with the impacts of climate change or grow cleanly, to deal with the gross inequalities of the world that we live in, you know, the fact that millions and billions of our fellow citizens don't have access to sanitation or fresh water or electricity, you know, these are real challenges for many of our people. They're still fighting for the right to food and water, and climate change will exacerbate that. And what they need is finance and technology to help them have an alternative model of development, a sustainable, people-centered model of development. And instead, what we saw was announcements of finance, which are simply repackaged money. These are money that's already been given for other needs that has just been relabeled as climate finance. And more problematic, what they've actually done here is that they've allowed now money from private sources, from multilateral banks, from the World Bank, to be included as climate finance. So now we have a situation where rich countries, who are historically responsible for creating the climate crisis, can lend money to poor countries to deal with the impacts of climate change, and poor countries have to give money back with interest. So the rich countries actually make money from the loans. This is just unjust and unfair. And then third issue that we're particularly concerned with is the fact that, you know, rich countries, particularly the United States, but also supported by the European Union, bullied some of the poorer countries into accepting that and a clause into the agreement which limits the liability and compensation for the impacts of climate change. So this is the equivalent of basically saying that rich countries can set fire to your house and not be liable for any compensation, except that when you rebuild your house, they may say, I'll bring the paint to paint your front door. It's so minimal. I mean, what we really needed here was not an escape clause for rich countries. So, and it's because of those reasons we say it's failed the test of justice, it's failed the test of climate science. Yesterday, a number of climate scientists had a press conference and they called the agreement between dangerous and deadly. And so we all know that to keep temperatures well below 1.5, it's what we do in the next 10 to 15 years that is going to be critical. Are we able to give hope to the billions of people by moving away from dirty energy and investing in people's energy, people's owned energy? Well, I'm not sure that strong signal was given, the means were given. The United States came into these negotiations with a mandate and a letter from some of their biggest multinationals who said that the United States must make sure that they remove all mention of intellectual property rights out of the negotiation text. And that's exactly what's happened. Now, that might sound like it's just a, well, what does that mean? But what it really means is that the technologies that they are meant to share with us, i.e. so allow us to be able to have the technology that gives us renewable energy, solar panels, that allows us to build alternatives, they no longer have to share with us, they can sell it to us. So this is actually what we're seeing here in reality. It's not an agreement on climate, it's not an agreement on environment, it's an agreement on political economy. Which economies will stay powerful, which corporations will stay powerful, and who will live or die. This might be a so-called legacy for Obama, but in reality it's a great escape for the big polluters, and it's a poison chalice for the poor, and that's not something that we want to celebrate.
Asad, it's very good what you are saying, because you are a person that has been following the negotiations from inside from years and years and years before, and we actually wanted to have it from you in this interview, in the sense of trying to get into the details or some of the details of this agreement. So I would like to ask you regarding this, what happened with the loss and damage mechanism, for example?
So in the loss and damage mechanism,
first, sorry, explain to the people what it is.
Okay, so the loss and damage mechanism is a recognition that we now live with climate impacts. Okay. The climate impacts that we see, that kill tens of thousands of people in super typhoons, in landslides, that affect millions of people in droughts and floods, but also the slow onset, the fact that sea level rises are increasing, we're losing our land, people, fisher folk and communities living on the coast, or our water tables are being polluted by seawater, so our access to fresh water is being impacted, or we're no longer able to grow our food because of the temperature increases. These are all damages that you can no longer adapt to. That our communities have been adapting to climate change for many, many years, but there's a limit to how much you can adapt to. Once you reach that limit, then you're into what they call loss and damage, which basically means the impacts of climate change that no matter what you do now, you cannot deal with. And so there was a demand by developing countries, pushed by climate justice groups for a very, very long time, that in the agreement there should be a mechanism that would consider this, would consider the fact that we're already seeing climate and environmental refugees being created all around the world. What happens when we see the mass displacement of people? Not in their tens of millions, but in their hundreds of millions. What happens then? What happens to these communities? What happens to even nation states that will disappear under sea level rise? These are all big questions, and they are not questions for in the next 100 years. They're questions that we will have to deal with in the next decades coming. And so there was an attempt to have this mechanism put in for the negotiations, into the agreement. On Thursday night, the Americans and negotiators, plus the European negotiators, got some small island states and some into a closed room. They negotiated hard with them, and they included into the agreement an explicit exclusion list. So exclusion clause. So this means that what they've done is that they have put in a clause which says they are not liable for any legal liability or compensation in the future. So what it is basically is, in the future, you as a community, you as a nation state, will not be able to say why United States or these corporations or your country carried on polluting and made me lose my home or my livelihood or my country. So they've basically got to get out of jail card free. It's an incredibly terrible, terrible decision. But it also shows the weakness of where we are politically. Because, of course, the strength of our positions inside the negotiations are determined by the strength of our movements on the streets and in our own countries. And we have to recognise that at this moment we're living in a geopolitical world where the political economy of dirty energy, where the voice of corporations is heard more by decision makers and by political elites than they are voice of citizens. If there's anything to celebrate about Paris, it is the fact that tens of thousands of people, led by Friends of the Earth, were on the streets mobilising and showing that people power action was the only way that we're going to transform our economies, transform our societies and build a kind of power that says that political leaders, when they come to negotiations, listen to the voice of us rather than the voice of polluters.
Okay, Asad, you have been mentioning specifically and most of everything the United States' role inside the COP. What could you say about other countries? I mean, if you have to choose or underline the negative role of some countries, which are these countries and why? And at the same time, if you have to say, okay, those countries did well in that and that sense, which were them? Sure. Who were them?
So, look, the United States has had an ambition over the last few years to fundamentally change the way we have climate regulation. So if you imagine, climate change is a problem of the global commons. It's a common good that we all have. Yes, it's the air we breathe. It's the water we drink. So it's a common good. And in that, we know that no one country can deal with this problem by itself, because of course, all the pollution doesn't respect borders. So to deal with climate change, you need a multilateral agreement, because what you need is, you need everybody to be taking action. The only way you can make everybody take action is if I do my fair share, then you will do your fair share. If you think I'm not doing my fair share, you're not going to do your fair share. Then, of course, if we're going to do our fair share, you want to make sure we do it, so you make it legally binding. Instead, what the United States has wanted to do is do two things. Is one, it wanted to shift responsibility away from those people who created the problem to those who have been dealing with the impacts. So you could say what the rich wanted to do was, they've grown wealthy on carbon pollution, but they now want to get the poor to pick up the tab and pay the price to clean up the carbon pollution. The second thing that they wanted to do was, instead of having regulation, science-based and rules, they wanted an approach which said you can do what you want based on your own circumstances. This is, of course, says do what you want as little as you can. It has no relationship to what the needs of people are or to the requirements of science. And it gives an illusion that we have plenty of time to be able to deal with this problem. And in reality, the climate scientists tell us that what we do in the next 15 years is is most critical. Because if we don't make massive transformations, then we're going to see us breaching all of these temperature guardrails that scientists tell us is so dangerous if they'll be catastrophic if we do. So the United States has been really the main driver of making sure its agenda is adopted here. It didn't want anything legally binding because it can't get it through the US House and Senate. It doesn't want to make any obligations in terms of climate finance. It wanted to limit those obligations, so it fought very, very hard for no new public finance to be brought on the table. The European Union, who classically have always positioned themselves as a climate champion, actually went along with this idea. What they said was, okay, we know that the United States is unwilling to do what it needs to do, but it's more important to have the United States on board. So if that means weakening the rules, let's weaken the rules. If it means accommodating the US, let's accommodate the US. And so the European Union, instead of actually standing and saying, maybe with more of the developing countries, saying, no, we are the ones who understand climate science. We say we understand the climate science. We should have a robust agreement that's legally binding, that's science-based. They actually accepted the United States paradigm. So what we wanted to do here was create a new convention. That's what was the idea. They haven't managed to do that, so that's a huge victory. What they wanted to do was create an agreement which they could then, in a 1 or 2 years' time, say, But this agreement is now more recent than the agreement which was signed by all countries in the world, the Climate Convention in 1992, which has these very important principles in there. It has a very important principle of the polluter pays, i.e. those who are responsible for the problem should pay to deal with the problem. They wanted to do away with the idea that the climate finance that is needed was new and additional. This means and public and from public grants. So they didn't want it to be new money, they didn't want it to be additional to what they're giving, and they didn't want it to be from public grants. They wanted it to make it loans. So in all of these things, that's what the real game from the United States was. Look, on individual issues, there were many different countries that came together to fight. And, you know, and it has been, I think it's a very shifting alliance. The G77 has done a really remarkable job in terms of holding together for such a long time. As I've done, I think, the like-minded group, they held together, and I'm sure that if they didn't hold together, we would have got an even weaker outcome than we got. But those are, in one sense, they are fights for at a diplomatic and a political level. So in that, you could say the developed countries won a lot. Developing countries didn't lose as much as they could. And the reality is maybe within the conditions in which they're fighting, the powers in the world, this was the best they could do. But of course, for people, that's not their consideration. The consideration for people is, did it? Was it just? Was it fair? Was it ambitious? Did it help them? And on that metric, they didn't win.
Then Asad, is it a legally binding agreement? And if it is, what it means?
So, well, there is a legal part of this agreement, and then there is what are sort of a decisions which are weaker than the, it's not a treaty. So there are some parts which is a treaty and some parts which are not. What's not in the treaty is the targets. What's not in the treaty is the number in terms of on the finance. So these are issues that the Americans had red lines on. They said we cannot agree to a treaty which has a legally binding outcome on the emission reduction target, the numbers, or on finance. So those bets are not legally binding. Where we see legally binding is much more on the rules and the reporting, the verifiables. So again, something that was very key for both the United States and the European Union. They wanted to say, we want to make sure everybody is doing the same thing that we're doing. So it's much more that they're setting up review structures rather than this. So the elements which are binding, I think, are not as strong. And the elements that needed to be binding are the ones that are weak. You know? But also now, I think the real fight will be, and we heard it on the floor of the negotiations last night, Nicaragua, for example, spoke very strongly against the outcome of the agreement, saying it was too weak. Bolivia spoke against the agreement as well, saying that it did not respect the science, did not respect 1.5, did not respect the carbon budget. So I expect there to be quite a bit of pressure brought on that. The South Africans, who chaired the G77, also made the point that the critical area of the pre-2020, both in finance and the promise by rich developed countries, which they made in Durban, that they would increase their targets, needs to be revisited. So I expect in 2016 that to be the major fight from developing countries to say, okay, we made the agreement, but now let's look at the detail. And in the detail, there are these things that still need to be resolved. So it's not complete. It's not over. It's not finished. And there, of course, by the very nature of these things, there will be continuing to be a fight between those who want to escape their responsibility and those who are saying, we are dealing with the impacts. We need more help.
Okay, just to finish, Asad, it means that the Kyoto Protocol is dead, or it's not dead?
No, the Kyoto Protocol isn't dead. I mean, they may wish it was to be dead, and they may not like to talk about it, but the Kyoto Protocol exists.
Okay, but if it is not dead, I know you are going to explain how it will keep existing. I mean, in which way the Kyoto Protocol and what it meant for, especially for the developed countries, will still exist and have to be respected.
So in Paris. Paris negotiations are meant to cover two distinct separate tracks. The first one, Workstream 1, was about how you create action, they say applicable to all, i.e. for all countries, between 2020 and 2030. Workstream 2, which was basically about increasing the ambition of the pre-2020. And this is the Kyoto Protocol, the commitment period too, because there was a recognition that the targets that were put in the Kyoto Protocol commitment too were weak and inadequate, that some rich developed countries like Canada walked away from them, others like Japan, Australia, didn't put any real concrete targets. And as part of the agreement to create the Durban platform, rich developed countries promised that what they would do was they would review their Kyoto targets. They agreed that there would be first a review, a high-level ministerial review, and secondly they agreed that there would be a scientific assessment of 1.5, and then that would also, they would then reconsider their targets in that light. Neither of those two things happened. Here, that was meant to be remedied, and there was meant to be a discussion about concrete action. Yet again, when you look at the paragraphs on the pre-2020 action, there are lots of nice words about its importance, but absolutely nothing in terms of its commitment and concrete. And let's be absolutely clear that this was not about putting on an additional burden, as they say, such to rich developed countries. The European Union, for example, has a target of 20% emission reduction by 2020. It met that target. It reached 20% last year. The studies now show that by 2020, it'll have made a 30% emission reduction target without any additional effort. That means that it could very easily have increased its target in line with its fair share. Instead, it refused to do so. So that when its target for 2030 was considered, it looked like it had done much more than it was actually doing. In real terms, the European Union between now and 2030 is actually only doing 7% emission reduction in concrete terms. So that was a real issue for many developing countries, and of course for much of the climate justice movement. We wanted to focus on what are you doing now in real terms, not what you're going to promise to do tomorrow. Because it's what you do now that has the impact in terms of the atmosphere that we're seeing, the impacts that we're seeing in terms of the levels of carbon pollution in the atmosphere and the impacts that we see all around the world.
Okay, Azad, would you like to add anything else before we end the interview?
Well, I would just say the call. Look, climate change, you know, is the greatest inequality of the world. Those least responsible are being impacted by the actions of those most responsible. 10% of the world's population are responsible for 50% of global emissions. The poorest 50% of the world's population are responsible for only 10% of carbon pollution. Climate change exacerbates poverty, exacerbates the right to food, water. It affects all of our lives already, and it will affect even more lives in the future. To challenge and to fight and to create and tackle climate change is not just simply about saying we must cut emissions and cut pollution. It's actually about creating a vision of a better world, a more equal world, a safer world, a healthier world for us all. That vision is what we need as part of the fight against climate change, a vision that connects where people are, so that those people who are fighting for land rights, those people who are fighting against deforestation, those people who are fighting for the right to food, are united together with those people fighting for climate justice. That movement of movements, coming together, being strong, understanding that it's the role of our businesses and our banks and corporations that drive the climate crisis, that what we need is a systemic analysis, we need a systemic solutions, will be the only way forward. The reality is we have no choice in this fight. We have to fight it. We have to win it. And the only way we can win it is when people, power, action.
Azad Rahman, Friends of the Earth, England, Wales and Northern Ireland, thank you very much.
Real World Radio, broadcasting free words, building popular communications by Fowai.